Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Maurice Ardouin, one of the hosts for the podcast Queer Voices of the South. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Daniel M. Harrison about his book, Live at Jackson Station, Music, Community, and Tragedy in a Southern Blues Bar, which is just being released this January 2021 from the University of South Carolina Press. Here's a little bit about the book. The smoke was thick, the music was loud, and the beer was flowing. In the fast and loose 1980s, Jackson Station Rhythm and Blues Club in Hodges, South Carolina, was a festive late-night roadhouse filled with people from all walks of life who gathered to listen to the live music of high-energy performers. Housed in a Reconstruction-era railway station, the Blues Club embraced local Southern culture and brought a cosmopolitan vibe to the South Carolina backcountry. Over the years, Jackson Station became known as one of the most iconic blues bars in the South. It offered an exciting venue for local and traveling musical artists, including Widespread Panic, The Swimming Pool Cues, and Bob Margolin, Tinsley Ellis, and the R&B legend Nabby Brown, who loved to keep playing long after sunrise. The Good Times ground to a terrifying halt in the early morning hours of April 7, 1990. A brutal attack, an apparent hate crime on the owner, Gerald Jackson, forever altered the lives of all involved. In this fast-paced narrative, Jackson Station emerges as a cultural kaleidoscope that served as an oasis of tolerance and diversity in a time and place that often suffered from undercurrents of bigotry and violence, an uneasy coexistence of incongruent forces that have long permeated Southern life and culture. Here's a little bit about the author, Dr. Harrison. He earned a BA in social sciences from New College of the University of South Florida, and an MS and PhD degrees from Florida State. He is currently professor of sociology at Lander University, and he lives in Greenwood, South Carolina, with his wife, their two daughters, three dogs, and two cats. Harrison's other work has appeared in journals such as Media, Culture, and Society, Sexualities, and Current Perspectives in Social Theory. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Harrison.
Thank you, Morris. I'm happy to be here.
Great. How did you come to write this book? You tell a little bit about that in the beginning. Tell our listeners how you came about this project.
Sure. Well, this project, I first started thinking about this project when I was actually finishing up my earlier book, which was called Making Sense of Marshall Ledbetter, which was a story about a young man, a Florida State honor student who broke into the Florida State Capitol one morning back in 1991 as some sort of political protest. And Marshall Ledbetter actually ended up being institutionalized, and he was diagnosed as being manic depressive, and that whole story, which happened a few years before I got to Florida State University, is all about kind of youthful rebellion and kind of politics and idealism and struggles for, you know, social justice and so on and so forth. And when I finished up that book, authors always need to have a second book in lined up. And one of the big questions that people ask, you know, sometimes, which is a little bit awkward, is someone said, well, what are you working on next? And luckily, I had a really good project, which was lined up next, which was the Jackson Station project. And I had first heard about Jackson Station a few years after I moved to Greenwood, South Carolina. I teach at Lander University. And my wife and I both are, you know, jam band, you know, fans. And we've seen, you know, the Widespread Panic and Phish. I never saw the Grateful Dead, but, you know, we really like that style of music and love going to, you know, those shows, or we used to like going to those shows before, you know, the pandemic and before we had kids and so on and so forth. And so I'd heard these rumors about Widespread Panic playing in my little town of Greenwood, South Carolina, which is not a huge metropolis. And normally when you think about jam bands, you think about, you know, them playing at Red Rocks and Madison Square Gardens and just, you know, the Fox Theater in Atlanta, for example, and other venues like that. And I couldn't believe the Widespread Panic had somehow played in my neck of the woods. And so I did a little research and found out that they had played at this little hole-in-the-wall club called Jackson Station, which was an old railroad depot back in the day. And I, you know, checked out the story with some other people, and they found out that it was all true. And then I heard the terrible news that that Gerald Jackson, the gay owner of the club, had been viciously attacked by a maniac in the parking lot one night with a bush axe. And so that got me thinking, that's kind of interesting. You know, the Marshall Leadbetter book, there was a little bit of a true crime, you know, non-literary or literary nonfiction, you know, work, I should say. And so I kind of asked myself, well, you know, I wonder what happened with Gerald Jackson and this attack. And then I was thinking, you know, maybe I could link it up to a discussion of the music. And the more I dug into it, and the more I started talking to, you know, the locals and, you know, the musicians and other people associated with Jackson Station, I just found out that it was an incredibly special place, a really kind of extraordinary space in the South during the 1970s and the 1980s. And so for the last going on six years or so, I've been spending a lot of time, you know, researching Jackson Station and learning all about it, and then putting some thoughts to paper. And so the book is the end result.
Wow. Thank you. That and let me congratulate you. That book, your book has so many entrees for different types of readers. I love that it's got a bit of history. It's got a lot about the Southern culture. It's got a lot that music, the impresario idea of Gerald Jackson, that he brought in all these musicians, and the diversity and inclusion that place represented. So that book, your book, I hope is going to do so well and invite readers from all places, because when I was reading, I was kept going, wow, this is going to be so cool when it turns into a movie. Because, you know, I could see the beginning of the movie with a vision of them hauling that railroad station, picking it up and moving it onto the property of the Jacksons. So it's so visual. You have so many ways to tell your story. You have so much research in there. It is. You're not academic, but it does not read like a tome. It reads like a thriller kind of. Sometimes you're going, wow, there's so much in here. So congratulations. I want you to tell us about South Carolina. Set the scene up in the 80s, in the 70s, when all this was happening. What was that? What's the South Carolina like that compared to now? Because it is different.
It certainly is different, but in many respects, it's not all that different. And, you know, as we are speaking here, you know, right now, you know, there's lots of news is coming out of the state of Georgia. And Georgia is, you know, is on the cusp of turning into a blue state, the new Georgia, the blue Georgia, as they're talking about. And I'm not going to, you know, count all the chickens before they're hatched and so on and so forth. But, you know, people are talking a lot about the urban rural divide in this country. And, you know, South Carolina has always been a little bit more rural than urban, although it is like Georgia. It increasingly, you know, you see a lot of growth in the Charleston area, in, you know, the Myrtle Beach area, Greenville area. Columbia is really kind of a booming, you know, city now as well. But back in the 1970s and 1980s, it was a pretty sleepy place. You know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, technology. Obviously, the internet wasn't invented yet. And these were the days of just very limited, you know, television access. You know, cable, I think, emerged in, you know, the mid-1980s. It was after the Vietnam War, which was a very traumatic time for, you know, all of the country, and especially the people coming home. Gerald Jackson was a Vietnam vet. He was a medic. He was a Navy medic in the Vietnam War, and he helped, you know, wounded Marines. And so he saw a lot of death and a lot of, you know, heartbreak and tragedy overseas. And he came back, and he was sort of at a crossroads because, you know, he was discharged from the, you know, from the military. The war was over, and he worked for some special needs, with some special needs children in Clinton, South Carolina, for a couple of years. But his real dream was to open up this blues bar. And at the time, Hodges and Greenwood County was very rural, you know, very agricultural. The pace of life was very, you know, slow, I would say, in comparison to how it is now. The cost of living was very reasonable, though. And so there were a lot of people who were, you know, were what we might consider, you know, quite maybe poor in the sense of not having a lot of money, but they didn't need a lot of money because rent was cheap and food was relatively cheap and beer was cheap. And coming out of the Vietnam War, the people I've talked to is, you know, telling me that it was actually a fairly happy time then because, you know, the war was over. You know, this was the 70s and in the 1980s, I think you started to have more of a me-centered, you know, ethos with, you know, Reagan conservatism and so on and so forth. But at the tail end of the 1970s, I think there was this attitude of, you know, let's celebrate, you know, let's party, let's focus on having a good time. Let's try to put some of the darkness of the, you know, Vietnam War, you know, years behind us.
Right. I'm from the South. I'm from Louisiana, deep South. I'm also from a very, very rich musical heritage state. As I was reading your book, it gave me so many flashbacks to growing up, being a young adult in Louisiana. We had our venues, and you mentioned some of them in the book, and in Louisiana and other places in the South. I want you to tell us about how Gerald Jackson came from that background and became I used the word impresario. He actually nurtured people. He brought bands in place, and they were from diverse backgrounds, pulling diverse audiences. It was not a gay bar, but it was run by two gay men. Very inclusive. That whole piece of this story is fascinating, and that's one of the reasons why you're perfect for our podcast. We talk about people, voices, queer people from the South,
yeah,
and the differences the changes queer people have affected, not just in things like music, but also in literature, in all kinds of arts. And so Gerald Jackson was one of those people. He was an impresario with music, but he also made a major difference in the state's history. Now you can't deny that what he did will never go away. It's something that he made a lasting impression.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. And I really appreciate that comment because that was precisely what I wanted to convey. You know, that's kind of one of the underlying themes of the book is, you know, focusing in on the biography of Gerald Jackson and how someone, you know, born in kind of, you know, backwoods, very conservative, you know, very traditional, quite Christian, you know, Hodges, South Carolina, could grow up to be this proud, confident, gay man in the South. And I think that, you know, talking to his friends, I think he knew very early on that he was gay, and it was something that he was just never ashamed of at any point in his life. And I think after serving in Vietnam and just dealing with just all the death and the misery. I mean, I'm sure you and your listeners know just so much about the Vietnam struggle and just, you know, just the just how bad it was over there and just, you know, people just getting shot left and right, stepping on, you know, landmines and then all the civilian, you know, I mean, he just saw so much. And so when he came back, you know, he was hardened and he was strong and he was tough and he wasn't going to let anybody intimidate him. So I chalk that up to, you know, generally speaking, his innate, very eccentric, you know, kind of personality. But he always had a way of getting along with everybody. And that was why he was, you know, perfect for being a club, you know, owner, music promoter, because he could just, you know, relate to anybody. He could talk to anybody. He could talk to all of his customers. And so, so all of these different kind of cultural groups, you know, would just fall in love with Gerald, and they and the bikers would go and they would claim Jackson Station as their own. And then the gays and the lesbians would say, no, this is our bar. And then the alternative college students would come in and they would, you know, claim their territory. And then you have the blues aficionados would say, this is the best blues bar in the South. And it really was kind of this, you know, kaleidoscope of these different identities, and Gerald Jackson was at the center of it, at the center of it, and his gayness, I would say, or his queerness was at the center of it too.
Right. He, like you said, he was so able to welcome all types. You mentioned you're right about widespread panic. They really didn't do blues. That wasn't their kind of venue, but he brought them in. And suddenly, it showed. It was one of the things that I think showed him that he was right. His instincts were correct. Bring good music in. It doesn't matter what it is, and people will come. And like you said, there were various audiences for different types of music. But a lot of people who preferred other or liked other types of music would show up as well, and then begin to broaden the whole scene began to broaden the awareness with the area. Yeah.
Precisely. Yes. And what's really interesting too is the proximity of Hodges, South Carolina to Athens, Georgia, actually. And that's where Widespread Panic is from. I mean, REM is from there, you know, Love Tractor and B-52s, for example. And because of that, Jackson Station represented a really good venue for a lot of the Athens bands to play, which was a lot closer than Washington, D.C. or New York City. And at the time, now there are a ton of you know, music venues in Athens, but in the 70s and 80s, there really weren't.
Right. They were little small places, but nothing on that scale at all, and nothing with that much variety going on. Everything, it was really niche. That's when I was telling you, I was a teenager in the 70s. And so I got to see a lot of the cultural shift from the way music happened then and the way it's happening now. I love that this is the part of the book that was so informative to me, because I had no idea how broad it was, mm-hmm. How many things were happening. You mentioned other venues in Atlanta and neighboring states. But this one prevailed, I think, because of its chemistry. We don't have enough time to spend as much and make this book could be just about music, but yeah. It's not. So we got a lot to talk about. So I don't want to jump too far, but tell us about Gerald Jackson and his mother. She was involved. His partner was involved making this work. And they gained the respect of the community. In a way that a lot of people would be surprised about to hear, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very fascinating part of the story. Gerald's father unfortunately passed away. I believe he was in his early to mid 50s when Gerald was 13. And so that left Gerald's mother a widow, and Gerald also had an older sister, Ellen. But Gerald's grandfather had been in the Hodges area as a grocery store merchant. He had a Jackson General Store, which was actually on the same piece of property that Jackson Station was on, going back to the 30s. And so the Jackson family was well established in the Hodges and the Greenwood area. After Gerald's father died, his mother had to take over the store, and she did that fairly successfully, but she had difficulty kind of managing it herself. And then, and eventually she ended up, you know, renting out the property and so on and so forth. But Mama Jackson, as people refer to Miss Elizabeth Jackson, was really kind of a force of nature. And sometimes Gerald would refer to her as the old white lady in a very good natured sort of a way. But she had a stake in the club. And when the club opened, she would have been in her early to mid 60s. And then she passed away in 2010, I believe. So, you know, she was there through the duration. She was actually working the club the night that Gerald was killed. Attacked. Sometimes I confuse myself because it's almost as if he did die that night, but he didn't. But she was a partner in the club. People tell me that she was the main financial backer of the club. She took the dorm money. And after paying the bands, she just took the rest. And it's unclear how much she gave back to Gerald and Steve. But my sense is that they basically got the bar and then she got the door after giving, you know, paying the bands what they needed. And we need to remember that this club opened at 5 in the evening and it went until 5 in the morning. And it wasn't uncommon for people to still be arriving at the club at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right, because it was an after hours venue. It drew a lot of people from when everything else closed.
Precisely. And so she would still be on that door collecting a cover charge. And you might have driven in from Charlotte or Atlanta or Charleston or someplace. And the first person you meet is this old white lady at the door, who demands a cover charge on you. But, and if she didn't like the look of you either, if she thought that you were, you know, giving her some lip, or if you were, you know, too intoxicated or something, or she would not let you in.
I love that about her.
Yeah.
She watched out. She had some business experience because you talked about that. But Gerald had his war experience. But they all figured out how to run this big old place. They had a kitchen. They served food. This was a composite, a package deal. When you were there, you could be there for the night and have all your needs taken care of. Like I said earlier, they nurtured these groups, these bands, because they weren't the bands at the time weren't treated so well at other places. But Jackson Station was known for being very hospitable to these groups. They would have their own special place in the back where they could hang out and eat and get ready and things like that. So I found that all very endearing, actually. It's a family operation. They figured out how to do it, and they did it beautifully.
Yes, and we need to also remember the other, you know, leg in the stool, in the three-legged stool, which is Steve Bryant, and Steve was Gerald's long-term companion, and he was basically the manager of the place, and so Gerald was the, you know, he was you know, with his mother, basically the owner of the club. And the promoter, and he was the host, and Steve Bryant, who was a little bit younger than Gerald, he was basically responsible for the day-to-day operations and making sure that, you know, they had enough grilled cheese sandwiches and so on and so forth, and that, you know, the bar was stocked and so on and so forth. And that triumvirate, you know, really was very, very powerful. And it was, and I don't think it could have happened without any one of those three individuals.
Right, definitely. You could tell that it was one of these efforts that it seemed everybody had a natural place. Like you said, Steve and Gerald and the mother each did something that complemented everything else. So really, there were no little warring factions about who was going to do what. It just fell right into place. It was so natural, and it lasted for about a good decade. Right, before the tragedy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So this is where we get into that piece that there's the word tragedy in the title of your book. Tell us about that. You mentioned that earlier that he was attacked. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think that if it hadn't been for the attack, then I don't think this would be necessarily worthy or have the value of being a full length kind of book, to be honest with you, because I'm sure that we could. And I love New Orleans, too. I've been there a number of times, not in a while, unfortunately, but New Orleans is one of my favorite southern cities for sure. And I just really appreciate the spirit and the vibe and the culture and the music and everything there. But you're right, for about a decade, Jackson Station was this thriving blues club, this iconic and very eccentric, you know, club in the South. It opened up in 1978 as kind of a salon, and they started having live music in 1982. And then for the next 9 years, they had a ton of music, and you can look at the appendix of the book and see all of the bands that played there, some of whom we've already talked about, and so on and so forth. And the club was getting very, very successful. You had Tinsley Ellis, who's one of the premier blues guitarists in the state of Georgia. He nominated it as being the ultimate Southern Roadhouse. The band, is it Pogo? What's the name of the Buffalo Springfield band? Poco. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Poco played there. And they were, you know, they were getting just large crowds. There was a big scene in Athens, and the students from Athens would come over, people from all over, you know, South Carolina would come, and so on and so forth. And Jackson Station, in a way, became kind of a victim of its own success. Some of the earlier patrons were a little nostalgic for the earlier days when it was a little bit more, you know, small time and a little bit more family, and you could go and still have kind of a conversation. But there came a point in time in the later 80s when you would have hundreds of cars in the parking lot, and you would have a huge line of people at 3 o'clock in the morning still trying to get into the club. And which was great because everyone loves the business and the money and so on and so forth, but it kind of became too much. And I think that's what happened on the particular occasion that Gerald was attacked. It was a big band night. They had, you know, hundreds of people there. They had the Muddy Waters backup band, was there. These are the people who, as the title would suggest, backed up Muddy Waters for a number of years. They had appeared in the movie The Blues Brothers. You also had South Carolina blues guitarist Drink Small. You had Fats Jackson, a great saxophonist from Atlanta, and Sweet Betty, an amazing vocalist also from Atlanta. They came over, and they were putting on an iconic Jackson Station blues show. When someone at about 3 o'clock in the morning ran into the bar and shouted, "Gerald has been attacked. Gerald has been in a fight. He's laying out in the parking lot." And Gerald had been assaulted by a patron with a bush axe. and the bush axe had been lodged 3.5 inches deep inside his skull.
Wow. And he, Gerald, was known for being a peacekeeper. He was very good at managing people and reading people. And so it came as a shock to, I mean, obviously it would come as a shock for any reason, but in particular with a person like Gerald, that he could, he did not defuse the situation enough to, I mean, he was blindsided. I don't think he was attacked in his face. He was attacked from the back, right?
Well, unfortunately, it's we don't know all of the details, and I tried very carefully to kind of reconstruct what happened, you know, surrounding, you know, the context of the attack in the book there. But yes, I think it's safe to say that he did not see the blow coming, and there was a discussion. There was some question of whether or not a cover charge had been paid, whether or not a debt had been paid. Some people tell me that there were basically two people involved in this incident out in the parking lot, a fellow by the name of Terry Stogner and also a fellow by the name of Craig Douglas. And these were two men from Greenwood who had been drinking together in Greenwood that evening down in the city of Greenwood, which is about 10 miles south of Hodges. And they had been consuming a fair bit of alcohol over the course of the night. And then they had decided to go up to Jackson Station to join the late night crowd there. Mama Jackson was on door. If you talk to the, or if you read the court transcript, these men claimed that they did pay a cover charge to get in. I have a witness who said that they did not pay a cover charge to get in, and that they climbed over the railing to get in because Mama Jackson had sent them packing because of a debt that one of them had owed her from the time before. But what we do know is that they were inside the club and that they were kicked out of the club by Gerald and the security guard. And then this fellow Stogner, he didn't take too kindly to being kicked out of the club. And so he started to engage in a verbal confrontation with Gerald. And that escalated very, very quickly into a violent confrontation with a bush axe that left Gerald bleeding to death on the dirt parking lot outside the club.
Right, and it rendered him totally disabled, according to his doctor. Right, he was not dead, but I don't like to use the word vegetable, but he became pretty much vegetative, right?
Yes, he was a quadriplegic after that. It's incredible that he didn't die immediately. Right. Given the nature of the attack, I mean, he was probably bleeding. It takes about 10 minutes for an ambulance to get to Jackson Station under the best of circumstances, and so a round trip would take at least 20 minutes. And then you have the time that it took them to actually get there. And plus, you know, the time that they were in the park and so on. So it could have been almost an hour before they actually got him to a hospital. And it was a 3.5 inch deep gash into the right side of his head. Yes, he was completely incapacitated. He had some functionality with his right arm, but from that moment on, he had to rely on the 24-hour care of other people, and Steve was a big part of that. Was a big part of his recovery.
Yeah, and that's. In the blurb for your book is where that was the beginning of the end of the place. And he lived, Gerald lived for several years.
20 yeah. years actually after the attack. Yeah.
Yeah. And Steve tried his best to keep it going. I'm sure a lot of people did their best. One of the things you mentioned earlier is that they were so generous to people. They let them keep tabs and pay later. And that was one of the issues that may have sparked this confrontation. I want to ask you about what you think, because there seems to be, you brought it out in the book, it's not necessarily agreement, whether this was actually a hate crime or whether it was fueled simply by a bunch of frustration.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting question. And I would say that the jury is still kind of out in my mind on that. This was one of the reasons for why I embarked on the project in the first place, was to investigate this as a potential or, you know, hate crime and so on. It doesn't seem to be a hate crime in the sense that there was no language in the court, you know, records and the police transcripts and so on and so forth that said that, you know, Gerald Jackson, you are an effing, you know what, or, you know, and oftentimes it's that sort of hateful language which we associate with the commission of hate crimes. So there doesn't seem to be any violent language that was directed towards Gerald because of the fact that he was gay. However, you know, in thinking about this for so many years, you have to think about the power and the animus behind a blow of someone holding a bush axe. And it sounds very gruesome, but you have to think about what it would take for one individual to actually strike another individual in the head with an instrument of that kind. And I think that you would have to be so filled with rage and so hateful yourself. I think that's the only way that it could be carried out.
Right, that makes sense. I guess it depends on your perspective of the people who were around at the time. Not very many people witnessed this, if at all. Most people were inside still. The parking lot did have a lot of history where a lot of things happened over the years, but it seems as though there weren't a lot of witnesses to corroborate whether that kind of hateful language might have been spoken. The fact that that Steve and Mrs. Jackson did their best to take the club, to keep it going. There was so much invested in it, not only money, but also their lives. It changed everything. Tell us about what happened. There was a court case, and you get to that. It's a wonderful chapter. I want to impress upon the readers that this is not just a open and shut case. It changed a lot of things, but it also ushered in a lot of other things that were positive. This inclusion and diversity that it left in the DNA of the region and the state. Like I said earlier, it hasn't gone away. It's made an impact.
Yes, you are exactly right there. You know, Steve was in a very difficult position because his companion, you know, his lover, his soulmate had just been, you know, violently attacked. He was in the hospital. He couldn't feed himself. He couldn't, you know, bathe himself. He couldn't, you know, he couldn't wipe his own, you know, behind. As I said before, he was constantly needed the care of other people, and Steve was, you know, the best person for the job, obviously, because he'd loved and cared for Gerald, but he also had a club to run, right? And so he couldn't kind of be in two places at one time. His mother, Gerald's mother, Elizabeth, also took the attack very, very hard. She blamed herself for the attack, and her health really went downhill after Gerald was assaulted. And there came a time when Gerald could no longer get the care that he needed in Greenwood, and he needed to go to Columbia. There's a VA hospital in Columbia, and as a veteran, Gerald could go there. And so he had to move, and he had to move from Greenwood to Columbia. And then Steve had this difficult decision about whether or not to go with him or to stay in Greenwood. And so he decided to go with him. and they shut down the club. They just couldn't make it work. You still had people showing up, you know, looking to party, looking to have a good time, looking to experience, you know, the wonderful music and the great culture and the vibes and so on and so forth. But, you know, there's obviously this big gray cloud, which is now hanging over the place because Gerald, who's, you know, this was his lifelong project, had been assaulted on the premises there. So they had to shut it down. And actually, a few more people have tried to open up Jackson Station since 1990 with very limited success. I think I chronicle it in the book, but I think there was maybe like three different sets of people who have tried to reopen the club and bring back the music. There's much of the South which has changed since that time period. Also it was very, very difficult to just kind of recreate the original vision, I guess, that Gerald had, and just the fact that he was so good at what he did, and Gerald was one of a kind in many ways. And you know,
right. Once he was gone. Yeah, you can't just replicate the chemistry that was there. You can't buy that. You know?
Precisely. But I think that Jackson State, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is that it really tells a very interesting story about diversity in the South. And when people think of the South, you know, they look at just the red and the blue. And for a long time, you know, going back to the New Georgia, Blue Georgia discussion earlier, you know, the South has typically been quite solidly red, and you might think, oh, everyone in South Carolina is a conservative Christian Republican, and oh, there's no gay culture in Hodges, South Carolina, or in the South, and so on and so forth. And the book shows that there was, and I think that there still is, you know, incredible diversity throughout the South. Rather, and it flies under the radar, but you know, it's there, and
you know. Yes, definitely, you're absolutely right, and it comes out in pockets and in big cities, but also in small towns, where people gather, they allow themselves, they create a life for themselves in a culture that is predominantly people who are not like them. So the LGBT community has for decades and longer made themselves home, at home, no matter where they are. Yes. And I find that aspect fascinating coming from there. I lived it myself, and now I live in New York City, so there's no such division. We're all really, you know, all blended, and you're on the subway, you see all kinds of cultures all meshing together. But in the South, it is very distinct. When you see drag queens in the street, if it's not New Orleans, you're going to look again, you know? Yes. You know, so yeah, I find that as a person from that community to be very endearing, actually, that the South has got it. It's still there. It's not scared people away. There are a lot of people like me who came for other opportunities, but that wasn't the reason I left.
And there's also this sense, I think, that, you know, South Carolina, I mean, you know, that our motto is, it, you know, is the I don't know if you've seen the tree, the palmetto tree, right?
All right, yeah.
Which it evokes freedom and liberty, really. And at the end of the day, I think that South Carolina, well, I should say Jackson Station, was known for allowing people to sort of live their lives to be free without too much worry to be paid to other people's judgments. You know, I think that we have this South, this image of the South that it is very, you know, puritanical, and you have a lot of bigoted folks and so on and so forth. But people will also leave you alone to a certain extent, I think, in the South.
Right.
There is an element of kind of creative autonomy, you know, there.
Right, absolutely, and there's also a pervasive. No matter where you come from in the South, you're taught to be polite, whether right. it's genuine or not. You're in polite company. You let people do what they want, and then it's behind their back that you say things, you know.
Yes.
But let me tell you, I think that's everywhere, not just the South, where you have you can get a lot of haters no matter which place in the world you're going to be. It's just how it's treated. And like I said, the old Southern thing is bless your heart means basically, you know, you're going to rot in hell.
Right.
But they're not going to say that to you in the same way. In the streets of New York, it's aggressive. I learned that when I moved here. People are very open and overt about mm-hmm. their bigotry. So they don't hold that in. They don't need to be polite up here. They don't feel like they need to be polite up here.
Yes.
So I find that a cultural shift. So it is charming to be in the South, to go home again and find a lot of evolution that has happened. And I look at Georgia, like you're talking about, and other places. My home state of Louisiana was not a red state when I was little. It was a blue state, believe it or not, but it was a Dixiecrat. There were kind of that was a whole different kind of blue. But to see what's happened and to see what the changes that are happening, like you said today or last night in Georgia, it makes you think that nothing is really – it makes you know that nothing is static. Nothing is staying the same. And you know, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, you got to be encouraged.
Yes. That's my takeaway message from it, because I think that people have had enough of just this xenophobia, you know, just this fear of difference. And the cool thing about Jackson Station is that people actually appreciated the difference, and difference was valued. People did not want to be in this homogenous environment where everyone was just the same, because that's totally boring, right?
Totally boring. Yeah.
And I think that hopefully we are reaching kind of a tipping point in maybe the public conversation that where that sort of diversity and just respecting, you don't have to agree with everyone. You don't have to, you don't have to always see, you know, eye to eye, but that demonizing the other, I think with, you know, what's going on over the last 4 years, I think we have reached the limit of the demonization of the other. And hopefully we can go back to more of a cosmopolitan, you know, sort of, you know, more of a Catholic with a C, you know, with a lowercase C, you know, where more of a pluralistic, I guess, you know, cultural landscape where everyone is valued.
Yes. Hallelujah. Thank you. I think that if we get there, I would be so thrilled because I'm one of those people. I don't like hostility. I don't think anybody really does. But some people feed off of it. It pushes me away when I see ugliness. I don't want to get online and be one of the screamers on either side. And I don't understand how people thrive on that. But that's the culture I think I hope that we're going to leave behind. I hope you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the neat thing about Jackson Station is that it sort of provided a model of what a place like that and what a culture like that looks like.
Right. We're getting to a point where I got to watch the time. I want you to be able to talk about what's coming next for you, the things you're working on. Where do you see the movement that's happening that we just talked about? Where do you think we'll be if you can project? If you feel as though the culture is going to shift too much, are we going to make incremental movements? I'd love some broad strokes predictions from you, Chico.
Well, as far as the next project goes, I don't have a big kind of book length, you know, project in mind like I did when I finished making sense of Marshall Ledbetter, which is probably fine actually, because you know books take a very long time to research and write, and you know there's lots of other things that I'd like to be doing other than you know just sit behind my computer, you know, typing. Writing can be a very solitary activity, but I am involved with a couple of projects. I don't know if you know too much about Benjamin Mays, who was the mentor of Martin Luther King, but he, funnily enough, is from Greenwood County, South Carolina as well. And he grew up in Epworth and in the Jim Crow South. and went off to Bates College and then the University of Chicago. And then he was for, 40 years, he was the president of Morehouse College. And that's where he met Dr. King and so on and so forth. So I'm working on a comparative study of Mays and W.E.B. Du Bois, actually, who was a very famous African-American sociologist. And I think that Mays and Du Bois both are just very important thinkers and individuals for our current moment, to be honest with you.
Excellent. That's fascinating. I think there's so much to be told. Your book, we're coming to the place where I have to wrap it up, but your book, Live at Jackson Station, this music community and tragedy in Southern Blues Bar, I want the listeners to understand that there's a lot of work that went into this book. It's very apparent. Congratulations, and it reads like a thriller. It is such a page turner. You should meet with only amazing success. I completely enjoyed got immersed in this book. Loved it. I read a lot because of I just liked reading. But this is one of those books that when you hear it's from it's research based and all that, sometimes you think, oh, what's this going to be about? I had to shift my brain. No. This you bring us right in. You note things beautifully, you back it all up, but you tell a great story. That's what I want the listeners to know. This is an amazing book.
Well, thank you, Morris. I really appreciate that. That really makes me happy too, because that means that I've done something right. And hopefully you won't be the only person who has that particular reaction to it. But I'm like you. I like the books which will kind of challenge your thinking and your intellect and so on and so forth. But there came a point in my career where I just kind of stopped being excited about reading, scholarly academic journal articles and things, right? And hopefully I've succeeded because it should be a book that you can read fairly quickly. And I would say there's actually four or five kind of mini books in there in a way.
Absolutely, yes.
And that the narratives, I try to tie up the narratives kind of all together. And so you could kind of dive into it, by looking at kind of the Gerald and Steve kind of relationship. You could look at that angle. You could look at the music, look at the community aspect of it and the history and the trains and so on and so forth.
Bravo again. You've done a beautiful job. The book is out this month, January 2021, in a couple of weeks, I'm thinking, after this recording is released. It's going to be available where all the books are sold online as well as in bookstores, I'm sure. It deserves a wide readership. I think you'll get it because, like you just said, the interest should come from people of all walks of life. There's so many great stories within this story. Congratulations again, Daniel. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this with us. It's the people involved. It definitely queer voices of the South you've represented from the Gerald and Steve story. But there's so much more than that. So congratulations. We appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you. Thanks a lot, Morris.
Thank you. Goodbye, everybody. Join us again next time.